We are continuing with our figures of speech in the Bible. This is our third section of what will be five total. And we want to just review real quickly. In the first lesson, we talked about the simile and the metaphor, which were both, one uses like or as, and the other doesn't, but it says that one thing is like another thing. Then there's the allegory, which is kind of a metaphor that continues and is extended. And then metonymy, where two things are closely connected because of some connection they have. We talked about that, like with the cup, when it was talking about actually the fruit of the vine that was in the cup, but Jesus said, this cup. And so we talked about those things. And our first tip for that week was, it is figurative if the literal interpretation would be absurd. Then we would start looking for a figurative example, understanding of it, instead of the literal understanding. Now obviously some things that might be literal may sound absurd to some people. You know, some people would say, well, Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead is absurd because you can't raise people from the dead. But we understand the difference in a miraculous thing that could be accomplished through the power of God and something that is more absurd, like we might say, you know, when Jesus talks about the camel going through the eye of the needle. We might say, well, yes, miraculously, God could make a camel go through the eye of a needle, but we think Jesus was just using that as a figure of speech because it's unlikely that that would have been the point to try to be making it a literal thing. In part two, we talked about the synecdoche, which is where we use a part of a thing to refer to the entire thing. So a lot of times the plan of salvation works this way. When the Bible will say, those who believe will be saved, or those who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. They're using that one part of the plan of salvation to talk about the entire thing, and they just use that one part of it. We say things like that when we say, keep your nose out of my business. We don't just mean your nose. We mean all, you know, just stay out of my business, but we will just say the nose part of it. Irony, of course, is where something was said that is the opposite of what was expected. Sarcasm, of course, is very similar in some ways to that irony, where something that's the opposite of what is meant is being said. And we talked about some of those examples as well, like when Job says, you know, no doubt you're the people and wisdom will die with you, to his friends that he disagreed with and did not think that they were being wise at all. In fact, thought that they were being quite foolish. And then hyperbole, which is just basically an exaggeration to make a point. And that again, kind of like Jesus saying the camel through the eye of the needle. He's exaggerating something to make the point of how difficult that would be. It'd be really hard to put a camel through the eye of a needle. You'd have to get it down to just little bitty tiny threads to get it through there. And so that would be very difficult. And then the second tip that we had from the second lesson was, something is figurative if the Bible writer says that it's figurative, says that it has a different meaning. Sometimes the writer just comes out and says, this thing that I'm talking about, it's a figure for something else. And so that then would help us to see that it's a figurative thing. All right, so our third tip for this week then, as we start into this week, is it's figurative if other Bible writers interpret it figuratively. So sometimes the Bible writer himself may say, hey, this is a figurative thing. Other times he may not specify that, but perhaps something from the Old Testament, a story that was told, and then the New Testament writer comes back and says, okay, this was a figurative thing that we need to understand this way. And so that interpretation then helps us to understand it better. So we'll look at some examples of that. Are we talking about John the Immerser or Elijah? In Malachi chapter 4 and verse 5, the Old Testament prophet says, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Now, that sounds pretty straightforward, and I'm sure that the people of Malachi's day probably thought, hey, Elijah is coming back. And in fact, even the people of Jesus' day, even his own disciples questioned him. They said, well, wait a minute. The prophet said Elijah had to come back first. Well, what was Jesus' answer? Elijah already came. Wait, when did Elijah come? Well, he explained it. So the disciples asked him in Matthew 17, verse 10. They said, why do the scribes say that Elias must come first? And Jesus answered and said, Elias, that's Elijah, truly shall come first and restore all things. But I say to you, Elijah has come already. And they did not know him, but have done to him what they wanted. Likewise, the Son of Man shall suffer of them. Then the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist or John the Immerser. So then they realized, oh, okay, that prophecy was not literally Elijah coming back, but someone like Elijah was going to come. And John the Baptist, John the Immerser, was that person that came. And that's who Jesus is talking about. So they understood that then. And sometimes there are things like that where we may not have understood it if the Bible writer hadn't helped us explain that. Oh, that's what that means. Because if we read in Malachi 4 or 5, we too would have thought, well, Elijah's supposed to come back. When's Elijah going to come? Many of the Jews today, those that are Orthodox Jews and those that are practicing Jews, when they have the Passover meal, they still set a place at the table for Elijah. They're still waiting for Elijah to come because they didn't recognize John was Elijah and then therefore didn't recognize Jesus was the Messiah. And so they're still waiting for that sign that Malachi had prophesied 2,500 years ago. They're still waiting. They're still expecting. And they've missed it. Oh, was it David or was it Jesus? In Psalm 16, verses 8 through 11, I have set the Lord always before me because He is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. Therefore my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh also shall rest in hope. For You will not leave my soul in, the King James says, hell. Others would say Sheol, the grave. Neither will You suffer Your Holy One to see corruption. You will show me the path of life. In Your presence is fullness of joy. At Your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. That sounds like David's talking about himself. You're not going to leave me in the grave. And I'm going to do these things. But in Acts chapter 2 and verse 25 and following, Peter on the day of Pentecost says, David wasn't talking about himself. He was speaking prophetically of another. And that, of course, was Jesus. He said, David speaks concerning Him. I foresaw the Lord always before my face. He is on my right hand that I should not be moved. Therefore my heart did rejoice. And then he says in verse 27, because You will not leave my soul in hell again, or Hades, is the Greek word there. It was the same as the Sheol of the Old Testament, the place of the dead. You won't leave me there. Neither will You suffer Your Holy One to see corruption. And the corruption there would be decay that comes with death. When we die, our bodies decay. And so he goes on to say then in verse 29, he explains that. He says, men and brethren, let me speak freely about our patriarch David. He is dead and buried. God did let David stay in the grave and let his body decay and see corruption. So what was David talking about? He goes on to explain. His tomb is with us to this day. But being a prophet and knowing God had sworn an oath to him that the fruit of his loins, according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne. He, seeing this before, spoke of the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, neither did his flesh see corruption. And so Peter says, clearly David died, he was buried, and he's still in the grave. Well, you know, now, I'm sure by now, he'd be dust. Return to the dust. There is no David body anywhere anymore. It's returned back. It's completely decayed by now, I'm sure. It's been 3,000 years. But Jesus didn't stay in the grave. He did rise. And that was what the prophecy in Psalm 16 was about. And again, one that many have missed today, sadly. Alright, so we want to look then at four more of our figures of speech and how they're used. We're starting to get into some that are a little less common. Obviously, the simile and the metaphor, we probably remember those from school when we had to learn those kinds of things. But those are common. We use those in everyday language, and they're all over the Bible. But we're starting to get into some that are a little less common as we move along. Personification, we talked about this last Sunday morning in our class on wisdom, because wisdom is personified. Wisdom, it's when you take an inanimate object or an abstract idea, and then you give that thing the attributes of life, the attributes of being a person. And so we talked about that with wisdom. The Bible talks about wisdom as a woman. The Bible talks about wisdom as walking in the marketplace and shouting out to, and calling out to anyone, come listen to what I have to say. That's a personification. It's describing wisdom in that way. And there are certainly a lot of those in the Bible. We can see a lot of things all the way back to Genesis when God is talking to Cain, and he talks to Cain and he says, sin desires to have you. Well, sin doesn't have any desire. Sin is simply an action that a human being commits that's contrary to the law of God. Sin isn't a real animal. But he even describes it. He says, sin is crouching at the door, kind of like a tiger ready to pounce on you. He describes it in this way. All the way back in Genesis and all through, these kinds of things are given life as such. Numbers 16:32 mentions the earth opened her mouth. Well, we know the earth doesn't have a mouth. It's a planet. But the idea of that, of the earth opening to swallow something up, if we've ever seen the sinkholes down in Florida and things on the news, you know, it looks like the earth just opened and swallowed something up. You know, and there are a lot of things like that that can look at. And we wouldn't. Here's the thing about figures of speech, and we've been studying the poetry on Sunday morning in our class. Poetic things, while we know they're not literal and not technically accurate, they paint a more vivid picture, don't they? I mean, which sounds more understandable to us if we said in Numbers 16:32, well, God made a crack in the earth and the people fell in it and then He closed the crack back up. Or, the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them. I mean, which is more vivid? Which one paints a picture that would say, wow? And now certainly, yeah, when God opened it up, that would be accurate. That's what God did. He was punishing those people. He opened up a hole, they fell in it, and then He closed it back and buried them. Yeah, that's what He did. But the way that Moses writes it in Numbers 16 there, where he speaks of the earth just opening mouth, swallowed them up. And so a lot of times that poetic language really gives us a picture in our minds. And you know, it's an interesting thing because that's how our minds really work, isn't it? That's one of the reasons we have difficulty with certain concepts, because our minds work on pictures. I mean, if I say ice cream cone to you, what comes into your mind? The letters I, C, E, or a picture of a cone with some ice cream on it. We think in pictures. Our minds work visually for the most part. And that's why it's difficult sometimes with abstract ideas like wisdom or justice or mercy. Well, I can't picture that like I can a car or an ice cream cone. There's not an image in there. And so sometimes the Bible and others outside the scriptures do this as well, obviously. They paint a picture, a word picture, to describe it in a way that is understandable to us. That we can really, oh, that's what it looks like. And then we see also in Isaiah 55 and verse 12, the hills shall break forth with singing. Now, I guarantee if we were walking around the hills, walking around the mountains here, and one of those mountains or hills burst out into song, it'd probably scare us half to death. I mean, that's just, hills aren't supposed to sing. We'd think something really weird was going on. Well, but the idea, that picture, it's a beautiful thought. You know, the hills breaking forth with song, just singing out their praise to God over what He's doing. And this, of course, in the midst of a section of Isaiah's been prophesying about the coming of the Christ and things of that nature as well. So we see that personification, it's a useful tool. We have that in, you know, we have statues in outside of courthouses of Lady Justice, blindfolded and holding the scales evenly, you know, and fairly, and blind to, you know, not looking at a person and judging them by what their station in life is, but just looking at the facts and being fair about it. And that's our image of Lady Justice. There's no Lady Justice. That's not a real person, but we picture it that way. And those images can help us so much. The second one we want to notice tonight is the riddle. A riddle is an analogy or kind of a saying, a question that's given as a puzzle to unravel. And when you unravel it, it will produce some truth for you. We like riddles. And oddly, a lot of times riddles are worded in odd ways so that you don't realize. The girls, they're 5 and 7, they're really getting into riddles. They've been spouting off riddles constantly while we were at the grandparents here last week. You know, they're telling all their riddles that they know. Things like, what has a face and hands but no body? A clock. Oh, okay. Well, an eye? No eyes? Oh, it has a face and hands but no eyes. See, I get the riddles wrong. But I get the right answer though, right? It's a clock. Okay. Got to get corrected by the 7-year-old. She knows it all, so she's got to tell me. But you know, there's lots of riddles like that. And we say those things in weird ways, but then it's kind of fun to try to figure it out. Figure out, well, what are they talking about? Because we know there's a trick to it. Well, one really good example of that, obviously, Samson gave a riddle when he was getting married. And he wanted to trick the Philistines, as he often did. And so he gives them this riddle in Judges 14:14. Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now, of course, we knew the story already of what had happened, how he killed the lion, and then as he traveled back later, bees had built a beehive inside the carcass of that lion, and he got some of the honey from that beehive. And so out of the eater, the lion usually eats people, came something to eat. And out of the strong, the lion's strong, he's the king of beasts, came something sweet. It was the honey. Now, of course, they cheated because they couldn't figure out the answer and they didn't want to have to... He made the deal with them that they'd have to all give him a new set of clothes. And they didn't want to do that, and they couldn't figure it out, so they got his bride-to-be, his new bride, they got her to find out the answer and then tell them. And of course, they threatened her. If you don't do this, we're going to burn down your father's house and you and your father in it. And we're going to kill you if you don't do this for us. And of course, they did. They convinced her, and she got the answer from Samson, and then she told them. And then Samson makes that really famous statement that no husband should ever say about his wife. Y'all know that one, don't you? Well, you need to if you don't. If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have known my riddle. Never something you want to say about your wives, guys. Not a good idea. Ever, ever. So here's a perfect example of that. Now, there are a lot of other riddles, if you will, throughout the scriptures. Ezekiel 17, 1 through 21 talks about some things, and in there it says to propound a riddle and to speak a parable. You know, Jesus came speaking in parables, and the parables were kind of riddles that people had to figure out. But in Ezekiel 17, 1 through 21, and even in a lot of the Old Testament prophecies, that's really kind of what those prophecies were. They were kind of riddles. And a lot of times, even the prophets themselves, they didn't know the answer. They didn't know the meaning of what they were prophesying about. They didn't fully understand what God's plan was. They were just telling the parts that they knew to tell. And so that, and really the entire Old Testament is kind of a whole bunch of riddles all packaged together to lead to Christ. And there, you know, the thing about that riddle is, like we talked about the face and hand, but no eyes. And we're like, what is that? But then when we say it's a clock, it's, oh, of course. It's obvious then, of course, the clock has, yeah, the face of the clock, the hand, oh, of course, it was so obvious, why didn't I see it before? But that's the way riddles work. They're obvious once you get the answer. Just like with Samson's riddle. It was obvious once we knew the story, but to those guys, they couldn't figure it out at all. And that's the way the prophecies worked. People really struggled. They really didn't understand the prophecies. But when Jesus came, it should have been clear to them, oh, this answers those riddles back there. This answers those prophecies back there. It should have been clear to them. Unfortunately, with a lot of people, it wasn't. It's still, they didn't understand it fully. So we have the personification and we have the riddle. And then we have this one. Paranomasia. That's, I know you were probably just talking about that all afternoon, weren't you? You were talking about paramnesias. It's such a common thing. Well, it really is. It's just, you ever notice? It's like onomatopoeia. Onomatopoeia, what's that? Well, it's buzz. It's a word that sounds like a sound. Buzz. Roof. You know, that's. But they got this $10 word to explain a simple concept, and that's what this one is. Paranomasia, I have no idea what that word actually means. But really, it's a type of play on words where we repeat words, the same word even, but with a variation in its meaning, in the sense of it. It changes its meaning a little bit. And we do this all the time. Most of the time, we do things like this, these little play on word things. We call them puns in English. That's a much shorter, easier word, isn't it? But that's basically the kind of thing that we got here. We see this in Philemon, except we don't see it in English. And a lot of the times, the repetition of words with the variation of the meaning, it doesn't show up very well in English when the once it's translated out of the original language, we don't see that. And so we lose a lot of it. But for example, in Philemon, the fellow's name that Paul is sending back is named Onesimus. Well, that doesn't mean anything much to us. But then he says, the one who was useless to you will be useful to you, in essence. It's kind of the English where, you know, useless, useful. He's got a little play on words going there. But see, the thing is, the name Onesimus means useful. But we don't. We wouldn't know that unless we, you know, look into that deeply. And so there are a lot of things like that that don't really come out in the translation. Another thing that happens is, a lot of times, what is the same word in Hebrew or Greek winds up getting translated with a different word in English, because of the fact that it was a different meaning in that place. And so we get two different words. We don't realize there was even a little play on words going on in those cases sometimes. One where we do see it in English, in Matthew 8:22, let the dead bury the dead. Now, is he talking about dead people burying dead people? Well, that couldn't work. Well, what's he talking about? Let those who are spiritually dead bury those who are physically dead. You see, he's changed the meaning of the word dead, but he's using the same word, but with a different meaning. And so there are cases like that. In Micah 2:1-3, woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil. Thus says Jehovah, this is further down 3, behold, against this family do I devise an evil. So he says, okay, woe to you, you're devising an evil. Well, guess what? I'm going to devise an evil against you. And so he uses the same terminology, the words devise and evil, in both what those the people were doing and then what he was going to do to them. Now, obviously, when we think of evil, we think of sin. Well, God wasn't going to sin. But also, when we think of evil, we think of something bad. Something bad was going to happen. So in the first case, he's using evil in the sense of sinfulness. They were working sinful things. He was going to turn it around and bring something bad on them. Not evil in the sense of sin, but bad in the sense of a catastrophe of some sort. And so that's something for us to think about. As we think about this, we have the same thing in English, and they had it in their languages too. We use this at times. We have words with multiple meanings. Puns work this way. Here's one example. Run. The word run. Crazy word. Run actually has 645 different variations of meaning. Different definitions that will be in the new Oxford English Dictionary when it comes out. that they're working on. Can you imagine? Well, here's a few of them right here. She did run for office, but had a run down her stockings and had to run to her car, to run to the store that had run an ad that it would run a sale. But it had run out of stockings, which caused tears and her nose to run. I had to run down this sad tale, and now I have to run. Every one of those uses of the word run means something different. And yet it's the same three-letter word. But it means something different. And so we see that in the Bible too. There are times where the same word in a different context means something different. And so we need to recognize that. And when we're looking for figurative things, sometimes we have to look at, okay, is, you know, because the most literal meaning of run is to move your feet real fast, and instead of a walk, it's a run. That's the most literal meaning of run. But it means a whole lot of other things in certain contexts that are very different than that. If you come in and say, James, I was out in the parking lot and I saw your car run. Does your car run on electricity or gasoline? We're not talking about it running fast with its feet like we would talk. There's very different words, and even though it's the same word. We have these things throughout our English language. We have homonyms, which are words that have the same spelling and pronunciation but different meaning, like run. We have homophones, where they sound the same, but they aren't spelled the same, and they certainly don't mean the same. We think about, like, there, and there. T-H-E-I-R, T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E, they are, and T-H-E-R-E, over there. So it belongs to them, it's over there, they are. And yet, all those words, they sound the same to us. And so sometimes, what would sound the same to them in their language, it doesn't necessarily come through when you translate it to English at all. And so it's a fun thing, though, we got to realize the literary side of the Scriptures. You know, we think, well, God inspired it. Yes, but there was a literary side to it where He was trying to get those people's attention, and He used some of their common sayings and their common ways of doing things, just like he would with us today. If he were to write the Bible in today's English, he would use some of those puns and different things that we use in our everyday language. He'd use some of those sayings like that. And then, of course, the final one is the homograph, which is a word that's spelled the same, but has two different pronunciations. So it looks the same on paper, but it doesn't sound the same when we read it, and it doesn't mean the same thing. For example, the dove dove. Well, those are both spelled D-O-V-E. But they're not pronounced the same, and they don't mean the same thing. So we have those kinds of things too. The fourth one that we want to look at tonight is anthropomorphism. There's another one of those big $10 words. And this is when you take human features or something about the human form and attribute that to God. You ascribe that to God. We know, the Bible tells us, God is a spirit. Jesus said that. God is a spirit. So he doesn't have a physical form like we have in his natural state. And we've talked about in our Wednesday night class that he could take on the form and the look of a human being if he chose to, and certainly so the angels and different ones did at various times. But sometimes the Bible gives God these human features. 1 Peter 3:12 talks about the eyes, the ears, and the face of God. But God's a spirit. He doesn't need eyes or ears or a face. And there's, as far as we know, no reason, no indication that as a spirit he has those things. In Acts 13:22, he's speaking of David, said he was a man after my own heart. Well, does God have blood pumping around? Does he need a heart to pump blood around in a body? No. He doesn't have a heart in that sense. And of course, there too, you may have even a play on the word heart. It may not necessarily even be referring to the physical heart, but after my own desires, after my own way of thinking about what's most important and dear to me. But there are many things in the Bible where we read about the Lord, and we read about God in ways that give him human attributes. And yet we know that certainly he was not a human being to have these human attributes. And we recognize that. We recognize that's a figure of speech, or at least we should. We need to know that we can understand the Bible, even those figurative sections. Now, obviously, some of them where the figurative language is wrapped up in the original Hebrew or Greek language will be harder for us than those things that come through into the English for us more easily. But we can understand the Bible. Are you growing in your understanding of the Bible? And more importantly, even perhaps, are you putting into practice what you already do understand from the Bible? And Mark Twain wasn't a religious man, but even he knew what the Bible said. And on one occasion, somebody asked him about how much of the Bible he didn't know. And his response was, "It's not the parts of the Bible that I don't know that worry me. It's the parts that I do know." What are we doing with the parts that we already do know? Are we living them out? Are we putting that into practice in our lives? Are we actively working to understand more of it, but live by what we've already been taught and have already learned? If you're here tonight and you haven't been, if you haven't been striving to understand the Bible better, if you haven't been living by those things that you have been taught and have understood from the Bible, you may need to respond to God's invitation tonight as we stand and as we sing.